Okay, we ended the class last Sunday, and I'm going to back up from where we were there. Let's stop right here. Jacob had fled from Esau. Basically, his mother had sent him away because Esau said, as soon as my dad dies, I'm going to kill him. His dad didn't die for another 107 years, so there really wasn't any rush, but the concern was there. And so that his mother basically sent him back up to her brother, who lived up in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, but in the western end of that region. And as he goes up there, he stops for the night near the city of Bethel. We talked about that he probably wasn't in the city, but near the city at that point in time. And since that time, the Jews have always called that territory, that city in that area, Bethel, because there is where he saw the vision of the ladder that reached up into heaven, and Jehovah himself standing at the top of that ladder, making promises to Jacob. Jacob woke up in the morning, said, "Surely this is the house of God," hence the name Bethel. Beth meaning house and El meaning God. And he promised at that point in time, if God would be with him and bring him back safely, that he would give a tenth to the Lord. Now, how that tenth was administered, what he did with it that made that tenth available, we really don't have any knowledge, direct knowledge at all. We can see that apparently this was common in this time. And we say that because Abraham did the same thing when he met with Melchizedek after the battle with the kings. And so there was some provision for it. We have no idea what it was. We would note that in the Levitical law, when that was given, the tithe was used for support of the Levites and any of the very poor people that lived in the land. So it may be that that was what that was used for. So Jacob goes on up, arrives near the city of Haran, and at a well there. He talks to the shepherds who have gathered there, but who have not move the rock away from the well, and asks if they know Laban, and they do, and say, "There's his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep now." And so Jacob went over and moved the rock away from the well, and help Rachel to water the sheep that she had with her. And this leads us to suspect that the shepherds were all young, possibly preteens. And so they were not able to move the rock. Jacob himself was probably somewhere in his early 40s, between 40 and 45 years old at this point in time. We know that Esau married at age 40, and Esau was married before Jacob fled from his father's tent and went up there. So he's probably in his early 40s. It could be, I suppose, that he's even close to 50 by this time, but we don't know. And Jacob agreed to work for Laban for 7 years, if Laban would give him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Now, he worked the 7 years, and Laban gave him Leah instead of Rachel. Jacob wasn't too happy about that. But Laban says, just give her her first week, and then I'll give you Rachel too, and you can work for me for another 7 years. So during this period of 7 years that he worked for Rachel, the second 7 years that he worked, these children were born to him. Now, with the exception of Benjamin. Benjamin I've got on this slide, but Benjamin was not born until after they were back in the land of Canaan. So we can see that these children were born. Joseph and Dinah were the two youngest. They were apparently born just shortly before Jacob left Padan Aram to go back down to Canaan. So he goes to his father-in-law after 14 years now. So we got to figure that Jacob is pushing 60 at this point in time, give or take 3 or 4 years probably. And that's guesswork. The scripture does not tell us those ages. So these children were born to them in this 6 years. He goes to Laban and says, let me go home. And Laban thinks about it. You know what he says? As long as Jacob has been here, I've really gotten a whole lot richer. I'd like to keep him around some more. So he talks Jacob into continuing to work for him. And Jacob works for him for a number of years, for 6 more years, in fact. Doesn't appear that any more children were born to them within that 6 years. That it was just that they worked there and helped him with the flock. Now, the deal was that any sheep or goats of a certain color that were born belonged to Jacob, the rest belonged to Laban. But it turned out that most of those stronger animals gave birth to those that belonged to Jacob. And his father and his sons began to get a little bit concerned about it, because it seemed like all of their proceeds and their profits and stuff were going to Jacob. And that apparently was what God was doing at the time, was causing those sheep and goats to be born that would be marked such that they belong to Jacob. So after 6 years, Jacob is realizing that his brother-in-laws aren't very happy with him. His father-in-law isn't particularly happy with him either. And so he decides that it's time to go. And they set out from there to go to back to Canaan, to where Isaac and Rebekah are still living. Assuming, now we don't know when Rebekah died. Isaac lived 180 years. He was, I believe, 60 when the boys were born. So he's a little over 100 years old right now. 100, 110, somewhere in that area. So he's going to live a few more years yet. But we don't really know much about him in that time frame, and he's not really mentioned except that at his death, Jacob and Esau buried him in the cave at Mamre. So that's kind of where we left it. Jacob has fled the house of Laban. He has headed down for back to the land of Canaan, and we see here this particular passage in Genesis 31 that Jacob, hearing Laban's sons are saying that, Jacob has taken away all our father's wealth and basically all of our wealth too. Rachel and Leah are pretty much concerned that they're not as welcome in their own parents' house as they once were. So there's a concern there. They say, hey, well, let's take what we've got and go. And so we see there that Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels and drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered. And we saw there that Rachel stole the household idols. We really don't know what these are, but apparently they were items of worship that Laban had in his household. We see this same term used in the case of David to indicate that it was we believe that was just an image that they had in the house, which was basically decoration, a statue, we might say. But in this case, it appears to be things that were object of Laban's worship. We see them then fleeing. He was up here in the neighborhood of Haran, which puts him up here in this portion of the Tigris-Euphrates area. And he's fleeing down this way. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us the route that he took, but this is the route that Moody's Bible Atlas suggests that was taken. It probably is a likely trade route that they were known to have followed in those days, and that's the likely route that they would have taken, but don't take it too serious. Jacob was in a hurry. He was moving fairly rapidly, and he might have taken chances like heading right out across the desert here to avoid, you know, that little loop up there that's going to take extra time. He's got children with him. The oldest are in the 13 or 14-year-old age group, and that would be Reuben. And the youngest are about six years old at this particular point in time. So he's moving with those, and he's moving with apparently a pretty good-sized herds of goats, sheep, camels, animals of livestock. So he's traveling. He's going to need to follow where there's water and sustenance for them, which is why he probably would have followed this route. But like I say, he's in a hurry. He might have taken a few chances. We don't know. This was not an area out here where people normally crossed. There's historical cases of one man at least taking an army across part of that desert a few hundred years from what we're studying now. But generally speaking, this was not an area where people really wanted to travel. So he came down here to Gilead. Now, he's in Gilead when Laban catches up with him. Now, whether it's really this far south or not, but this is the area on the map where they tell us that Gilead would be found. I always suspected it was further up here, and we don't know. We're told it was the land of Gilead, and historically the archaeologists tell us where that could be. It doesn't mean it didn't change around a little bit over the years, and that this one is a time that was 500 or 600 years later. But this is where it was, somewhere in that particular region. So Laban has caught up with Jacob down in the land of Gilead. God, though, has spoken to Laban and basically said, you don't touch this man. That's not the words that were used, but that was certainly the way Laban understood it, that God was protecting Jacob, and he could meet with him, but he wasn't to be too serious about it. He was to be something that they went on with and separated peacefully without any loss of life or property. So we have then Jacob fleeing down there. We talked about what the word gods meant there, the household idols. Rachel had hidden the idols in the saddle of the camel that she had been riding. And she tells Laban, she's sitting on the saddle and tells Laban that she can't get up because the manner of women is upon me. That phrase apparently means she was having her monthly period. Now, again, we're dealing with laws that were given later, that in the Levitical law, in the law of Moses, this would have been a problem that anything she touched was unclean. And so that he wouldn't have touched the saddle to search it if she had sat upon it with a flow of blood. And that was certainly what the Old Testament law, the law of Moses, which is given 400 and some years later, would have said. But apparently this custom or law from God was upon them even at this particular point in time. Okay? And Rachel is certainly not above lying at this point in time. We know she stole the idols themselves. Whether she wanted them as idols of worship or just things of value that could be sold or traded for other things of value, we don't know. But we do know she was a thief. She took things that didn't belong to her. And that's basically where we ended last week. That we have got to this point. Laban has searched the tents. He has not found anything of value that was his. Doesn't mean they weren't there, but they at least were not things that Laban managed to find. Now, whether or not the hand of God was upon that caused Laban not to be so untrustworthy that he thought his daughter might lie to him about what the situation was, we don't know. But we see God is indeed looking after Jacob and Rachel at this particular point in time, even though the Rachel's behavior is not what we would expect and want to see among our children anyway. But Jacob becomes angry. And it says here in Genesis 31:36, he became angry and contended with Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that we may decide between the two of us," or set it here. "These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was by day, the heat consumed me, and the frost at night, and my sheep sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock. You have changed my wages 10 times. The God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night." And that judgment last night was not a thing of violence. God did not do any violence to Laban. He just spoke to him. And And Laban had enough fear of Jehovah God that he did not doubt and try to defy it and go against what God had told him. Now, whether Laban was a worshiper of Jehovah or not, we don't know. But he did see him and fear him. Or at least he saw him in the vision, heard him in the vision, and feared him enough that he wasn't about to lay a hand upon Jacob at this particular point in time. So, and Laban replied to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." And Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. It's the second time we have seen Jacob do this. Anybody remember where the first time was? When he had the dream there at Bethel. So he sets a stone pillar up. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, but Jacob called it Galeed, the heap of witness. And apparently the name that Laban called it is the same thing in the Aramaic language. And that Galeed was the language of Jacob. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore it was named Galeed and Mizpah, what, which means watchtower. For he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you mistreat my daughters or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. And Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal. And they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons, his daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. What happened with Laban after that, we don't really know. Mike? Yeah, that is basically, it's apparently the same thing in two different languages. And so this pillar of stones in the wilderness, somebody else coming across it that never heard this story would have no idea why somebody had piled up this pile of rocks there. But it was there, and to them, passing that in anger, an attempt and plan to do harm to the other, was something they had agreed not to do. So this forms a boundary between them that they will not pass for doing them harm. Now, we notice here also that Jacob made a sacrifice, but they ate it. So What are we seeing in this sacrifice? Now, we don't really know what they did in terms of sacrifice at this point in time. We know that under the law of Moses, certain sacrifices were just burned up, completely destroyed. But a thank offering, a sacrifice to make witness to this covenant that they have done would have been more in that category. A portion of that would have been given to the priest. The rest of it, the people who offered the sacrifice would eat it. So we have then here another example of this some kind of the sacrifice. Now there was no priest there for them to give a portion to. So whether they did this as a form of worship, apparently is the case, but they may very well have eaten all of it. Again, we don't have any knowledge of that. It's very much like the tithe that Jacob promised to give, but we don't know who he gave it to or what he did with it to give it to God, but that was what he did. And so we see this sacrifice being offered and them eating a meal there at the time of the sacrifice. Presumably the animal that they sacrificed is what they were eating. Yes, Don? Well, yeah, that's about 400 years down in the future, but
it's like when Abraham gave the offering to Melchizedek, the priests were in his voice.
Yes, it says that in the New Testament. And that may very well have been the case, and the Jews may have looked at it that way. But exactly what they did and how they made this offering, we don't know. Mike? Well,
this goes to show us that it doesn't require us to enter into some kind of covenant with some other person to have peace with them. We can agree to be peaceful and then, make that something that we bind ourselves with in terms of our reverence for God and our character.
We note here, though, that Laban apparently was familiar with Jehovah. Whether he was worshiping him or worshiping him exclusively or not, we're pretty sure it wasn't exclusive because of the household idols, and they were apparently objects of worship. But Nahor was Abraham's brother. Nahor was Laban's grandfather, I believe. Bethuel was the father of Laban. So he knew of Jehovah because his family had worshipped Jehovah for many years, apparently. Apparently Terah, Abraham's father, was a worshiper of Jehovah. And again, we don't know how faithfully, how uniquely he worshipped him. I didn't make a slide about it, but when he notes here, he's talking about the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor. So this is the God of our immediate ancestors. The God of their father, which would have been Terah, judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Now, what does that phrase mean? He's afraid of his father, or by something his father feared? By something his father feared. Now, I suspect the term fear here is not what way we tend to use the word fear, but probably would be better translated as awe. This is the one whom Isaac was in awe of. So they're swearing by Jehovah is basically what we're saying here, that they will agree to this covenant, that they're not going to pass this pile of rocks and this pillar that Jacob has set up for to do each other harm. And again, Jacob offered the sacrifice there on the mountain, and they ate and spent the night there. In the morning, Laban gets up and heads back north. Yes, Don?
I've got a question. Wasn't the name Jehovah revealed to Moses? Because didn't God say to Moses, by my name Shabbat, God Almighty, I was known to your fathers, but my name is Jehovah.
That's very well possible.
So these people who worshiped God Almighty, El Shabbat, who
Yes.
So that's how it was passed down. So the god of Terah and the god of Abram and Nahor would have been the god of Terah, so it went all the way back to that.
Yeah, and this is how Jacob is identifying this God. It's the God that our fathers worshipped, or worship. Abraham was probably dead by this time. If I have to think about that now. Abraham would have been dead for a few years at this point in time. Isaac was still alive and probably had another 70 or 80 years of life ahead of him. This is how that they are identifying the God that they're worshiping. It's not that this God is called Jehovah by these people at this time. I'm not aware of any of that. Haven't looked at it at all that way, but that would be what I would expect. He's just identifying it so that everybody is on the same page, they're knowing who they're talking about, what God they're talking about at this point in time. Because certainly at this point, there were many other gods that people worshipped. Okay? Any other comments? So now, Jacob went on his way. The angels of God met with him. Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. And he named the place Mahanaim, which means a double camp. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight. The messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you. With 400, and 400 men are with him. Boy, now that's going to make Jacob feel really, really comfortable, don't you think? Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. So he was doing his best and thinking about just how am I going to protect part of my family from Esau. So Jacob is not returning in secret. He's not going to try to sneak into the country and get back into Isaac's camp before Esau gets there and finds out he's coming. He sends to get to him. Now, Esau has apparently already moved south. The land of Seir, as mentioned here, is down near the Gulf of Aqaba, that arm of the Red Sea that points up to the north, points up toward the Dead Sea. So he's apparently living down in that particular country, which is where his descendants will be found up until almost the time of Christ, living in that area. There is war between Israel and Edom, which is the descendants of Esau, for pretty much their whole existence. That may have ceased by the time of Christ, because Herod was an Edomite. It wasn't clear, but it still was clear that Israel was the dominant tribe even at that particular time, at the time of Christ. So Jacob sends a message. Esau sets out to meet him. Not sure what I would say of Esau's judgment at this particular time and gathering up 400 men to go up to meet his brother that when they last had any communications, it was, I'm going to kill you as soon as daddy dies. It's kind of a situation that certainly would distress Jacob. And God may very well have intended it that way, that Jacob would have this fear, and perhaps recognized that some of this is coming about because he tricked his father, he lied to his father just to get the blessing and to get the, and he didn't really trick Esau to get the birthright, but at least it was not his to have, and he bought it from his brother for a paltry sum that didn't really amount to very much. Whereas if he had gotten the inheritance, it would have been a lot more of his own. But Jacob has not done too badly himself. I mean, he has male and female servants. It's not just the older boys that are out there herding these flocks as they're heading south. Jacob has servants with him to help to do that. But undoubtedly, these children were out there and participating as well. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brethren, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. So Jacob is turning to God at this particular point in time. He's not turning to flee. He's proceeding on. God told him, you go back. And so he's going. And we see here that there is certainly a trust in God, but yet the fear is there as well. So, God, what is it going to cost me to return? If Esau comes and falls upon this group, is some my family going to be killed? Am I going to be killed? He's concerned about these things as well. He seems to have faith in God. He says, you promised me this. Now I'm expecting it of you. And can we expect the things of God that he's promised? Well, he kept his promise to Jacob. So we've no reason to expect him not to keep the promises that he makes to us. So this is the kind of thing that we see here. So at this point in time, unlike Abraham when he went to Egypt or to Gerar, or Isaac when he went to Gerar, we don't see them turn to God and say, you know, he's helped me through this area. They wanted to use trickery. But Jacob indeed at this time turns to prayer. Mike?
In so much of what we read in the book of Genesis and the life of the patriarchs, I think there is a typology of Christ. And in this account of Jacob's return here he is, you know, sent of God into his own people. And he has the anticipation that his own people will reject him and even possibly kill him. And we see, you know, a parallel there, at least I do, in God sending his son, Christ. The difference being that it turned out well for Jacob.
Yes.
It didn't turn out so well for Christ in terms of his life.
His physical life and existence upon the earth.
God worked both to accomplish his purpose.
Okay. But we do see here on the part of Jacob, there is faith in God at this point. He just doesn't know exactly how God is going to answer the prayer. And do we ever find ourselves in that situation? God, I know you promised that all things would work together for good to those that love the Lord, but how is what's happening to me right now good? And it's common. It's human nature. It's the way all of us basically tend to live. And so it is, you know, we can see here that Jacob isn't someone who's going to stand up on his legs and just shout, "If God's with me, nothing you can do is going to harm me, Esau. I'm just going to charge on forward." But he very humbly turns to God and says, "God, you've made me some promises, and now I certainly expect you to carry through with them." Andrew? Yep.
I think that's not necessarily a bad thing to do sometimes.
No.
God has made promises to us, and it doesn't hurt for us to in a prayerful, respectful way, the way Joseph is doing here, Jacob is doing here, to remind God that he said he would take care of us.
Yeah, we shouldn't be accusing God of not taking care of us just because things aren't going the way we think they should be going. We need to recognize that God's going to do things His way in His time, and we may suffer some in the meantime. But in the long term, that's what God has promised He is going to fulfill. Okay? So let's look at the events that happened. So he spent the night there, and he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hands of his servants, every drove by itself, and he said to his servants, "Pass on before me and put a space between droves." He commanded the one in front, saying, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, say, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going, and to whom do these animals in front of you belong?' Then you shall say, 'These belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau.'" Now, note here that the respectful terms that Jacob is using. He's my lord Esau. Now, that is placing Esau in a position of power and authority over Jacob. That's the position that Jacob is putting himself in before Esau by using this kind of terminology. When he says, "Your servant, Jacob," here, the idea of servant is not so much that somebody that you've hired to do some work for you, but this is a slave. In this particular time and terminology. So, my lord Esau, your slave Jacob, is the kind of position Jacob is putting himself in when he uses these terms with respect to Esau. And it says, "And behold, he is also behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the drove, saying, 'After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, Behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on before him, while he himself spent the night in the camp. And he rose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed over the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had." So, I don't think I've got a map. Yeah, we do. This is the river Jabbok here. Now, you note here at the bottom, here's the Dead Sea. So we're going up the Jordan. Here's the Jabbok River. Flowing down here into the Jordan. So he's somewhere in this region. Don't know exactly where, but it's somewhere along that river. And he has sent his family and all his property, everything across the Jabbok. So he's heading further south, and this is where he has gotten to at this particular point in time. I note it's also interesting that he sent his 11 children across. What happened to Dinah? He had 11 boys, and then Dinah. So he sent his 11 children across. They're only counting the boys at this particular time, because there really was at least 12 children. It's possible that some of the others had born daughters as well. But Dinah is the only one that is mentioned. And so, you know, we see that here. And I found that was interesting that it's only the boys that he's counting when he sends them across. Says only the boys were important at that particular time, at least in that sense. We'll get more back to Dinah in a while. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. This could get to be a little bit confusing. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him. When he saw, who was he? He was the man that was wrestling with him, had not prevailed against him. Then he touched the socket of his thigh. So this is not really a man that he's wrestling with, but an angel. But the angel is in the form of a man, and he is reacting as a man would have reacted. He's not showing the power and the strength that God had in his angels. I mean, this is the kind of a being that can come down and destroy 185,000 men in one night. And yet he wrestles with Jacob all night long and does not prevail against him. Jacob is holding out very, very solidly against this particular angel. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, again, this would be the angel, I will not let you go unless, Jacob said this, I'll not let you go unless you bless me. For he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob," which means supplanter, "but Israel, you who have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Again, I put, if it's in italics, I inserted it, not in the scripture itself. And Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." Notice he's respectfully speaking to this individual, because the term "please" there would certainly indicate that. And he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, face of God. And I should have italicized that. I don't know why I didn't. For he said, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore to this day the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. So this became to them a tradition. Not something that we see God has commanded, but this particular portion of any beast that they are going to eat, they will not eat, because that's where God touched Israel. Again, these events all took place right up here somewhere in this region. Don't know whether it's down here next to the Jordan or back up further in the hills. My guess would be further back up. There has to be a ford there, and you probably wouldn't find a ford down close to where it joins the Jordan. Bill? Well, our time is up.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll wait till next week. Kind of a mystery why this wrestling match took place.
Right. We're not told why.
We're not told that God was displeased with Jacob, or if he was just testing him to see if he would endure. So maybe next week.
Florento?